Losing ground, the winter waves pound our shores and wash away our beaches. This season, Sunset Beach is taking a beating, and the public is being asked to stay away from a section where a bike path has been taken out by the waves, resulting in a 20-foot drop along the roadway. Over the years, we've seen sandbags in use along the coast in Lanikai and on the South Shore in Waikiki, where the shoreline is man-made. An experiment with a sand mattress is underway. Joining me now is University of Hawaii Geology Professor Chip Fletcher, who's been a constant and strong voice with what science is telling about our shorelines over several decades. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what can you share with us? You were out at Sunset Beach that day, I think, at the news conference. What's the takeaway there?
Well, this is the latest in several episodes of extreme erosion that have taken place over the last couple of years. You might recall in 2014, I think it was, the area around Rocky Point, a number of houses got undermined. I think someone's pool actually fell in. Now Sunset is experiencing extreme erosion. In all these cases, the shoreline is moving landward because of the waves, but the sort of quiet operator behind the scene is sea level rise, which, as the ocean rises, the shoreline has to move landward.
Right, and you had an article published in Civil Beat today where you talked about the positive thing is that Mayor Caldwell has acknowledged that we need to do something about this problem.
Yeah, Mayor Caldwell came up with the remarkable words, we have to learn to live with water and soften the shoreline. And what he's acknowledging here is that sea level is rising. It has begun to accelerate. And in coming decades, we're going to be seeing dramatic forms of flooding and coastal erosion throughout the islands. And what's going on in Sunset Beach this week and last week and what happened a few years ago are not isolated incidents. They're a glimpse of the future.
Right. And we were talking about, 20 years or so, we saw the situation in Lanikai, and homeowners there put in some sandbags, which I guess are still there?
Yes, they are.
And so what's the takeaway on the sandbags? Do they work?
Well, sandbags were an experiment to not build rock walls, but instead put in something that was conceived to be temporary at the time. It's turned out that in several locations, the sandbags still exist 10, 20 years later. Lanikai is not the only place with sandbags. They've been used in several other locations. They essentially end up being the same as a rock wall. They are permanently hardening the shoreline.
Right. And those sandbags have held up.
They have held up. There is some vandalism to them, but they are still there. Yeah.
And then the experiment with the mattresses in Waikiki, how does that work?
That was to cover an exposed foundation from an old tavern that was dangerous for tourists. If they could twist an ankle or walk on, pieces of rock that could hurt them. In all these cases, the sandbags and the mattress, the idea is to protect the land. Case of the mattress is to protect the tourist because of exposed foundations, but they don't deal with the beach. The beach itself is of concern, and what we need to focus on is beach management rather than land protection.
Okay, so how do we do that?
Well, it's a very difficult situation in a place like Waikiki where you have largely an engineered beach. I believe it's appropriate to spend money to maintain the beach. It's like building a highway. It deteriorates over time and you need to maintain it, and we do that by putting sand on it. There were some mistakes made in the 2012 beach nourishment episode in Waikiki that hopefully we can correct next time. We do have a beach there along most of Waikiki, and we probably would not have one except for the beach nourishment in 2012.
What was the mistake there?
The sand was partially ground up, we believe. These sand grains come from the reef. They're very fragile. They're easily broken. And the dredging and delivery process that was used broke the sand grains. And so we see some milky water as a result of that.
So the water quality is not all that great.
Well, during the time of the beach nourishment and during high wave periods, that's the case. But there are other beaches, country beaches, if you will, where the cost-benefit ratio doesn't suggest that the millions of dollars spent at Waikiki would be worthwhile. And in fact, we just don't have the budget for nourishing every beach that is eroding. And so you need to think about how are we going to get out of the way of the shoreline as it migrates landward? What is an exit strategy for beachfront homeowners and for highways?
Are you aware of where this is happening on the neighbor islands at the rate that it's happening, you know, like we're seeing in Waikiki?
Maui is experiencing coastal erosion far worse than Oahu and Kauai. One reason is that the rate of sea level rise is higher there because the island itself is subsiding because of the young age of the shield volcanoes. But that rapid rate of sea level rise means that they're experiencing erosion on over 90% of their beaches, many of which have been armored with seawalls over the years and have disappeared as a consequence.
Are we doing better on seawalls?
I like to think that we are moving in that direction, especially with the mayor's recent words. We need to soften the shoreline.
Right. We do have that Office of Sustainability that he has created, and we do have DLNR that, you know, looks out for the resource. But if the departments are still signing the permits for structures being built too close to the coastline, what do we do?
Well, so many of our beachfront lots were developed decades ago. It was actually decades ago that the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Program came into existence following a federal coastal zone management that was created under NOAA. Unfortunately, the rules that were put in place back in the 70s to guide shoreline development in Hawaii and elsewhere in the United States did not recognize the reality of sea level rise. And since then, we've had an increasing number of roads and homes that are exposed to the moving shorelines. And as I said in my piece in Civil Beat this morning, there's a slow motion collision taking place.
And so what's the answer? You know, do Band-Aid measures to kind of stop the structures from falling in right away?
This is a problem that should be characterized as needing management, not fixing, because you can't fix this problem. It is extremely difficult. There are no ultimate winners. I hope that in decades from now, we still have beaches so that, you know, families in Hawaii in the middle of this century, despite the fact that sea level's rising, still have beaches to go to. But if we protect all the beachfront homes and roads with seawalls, that is not likely to be the case. So we need to figure out, if you will, what is the triage here? What areas have beaches that we absolutely must protect? And what areas are we willing to build seawalls because we feel that what's on the landward side of the shoreline is more important?
In Waikiki, which is, you know, basically the economic, you know, driver, right, for tourism, you have that experiment going on with the mattresses. Where did that idea come from? Where did you steal that from?
The mayor's administration came up with that. I think, Rick Eggett and Dolan Eversall, who are part of the Waikiki Improvement Association, were in a conference in Miami Beach, Florida, and they learned about the beach mattress, the sand mattress there. They thought it would be useful for that little corner of Kuhio Beach.
And do you think that'll lend itself to other areas?
That's a small little problem, a little Band-Aid for a corner of the beach where erosion has exposed an old foundation. There's a much larger issue at play here. We have hundreds and hundreds of homes. We have miles and miles of road, all exposed to erosion either right now or in coming decades. How are we going to move out of the way of the rising sea level and still have some beaches? Or are we not going to move out of the way? We also have to keep in mind that it's sea level rise doesn't just cause the shoreline to move landward. It also causes the water table under the land to rise. And so at the same time that the shoreline is eroding, there are new wetlands forming underneath our homes and roads, mauka of the shoreline, because the water table rises with sea level rise. And, you know, a wetland is where the water table is sitting on the land surface.
So let's talk about that, because we do have some areas, I think North Shore, you've got the Wildlife Preserve out there by Campbell. What's the effect on that?
So in a place where you have a natural setting, such as a wildlife preserve, there are maps available for the managers of that setting to see what areas are more likely to flood in the future, where is there erosion taking place, and they can adapt their management methodologies to these futures that they see. The maps show them, under, say, 6 inches of sea level rise or 1 or 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise, what areas are vulnerable and what areas are not. I have to say, though, a lot of our wildlife managers are busy day in and day out with the brush fires of feral cats and invasive species, and they are really understaffed and under-resourced. Just throw that in there. Kudos to our wildlife managers, because with the daily onslaught of problems that they have to solve, to ask them to look forward several decades is a challenge. They do it. But they have problems right now that we need to deal with.
They have a lot of alligators in their swamp to deal with.
A lot of alligators in their swamp. And in fact, that plays into the problems with climate change, because if we can clean up the problems now, the natural system will be more resilient to the stresses that come as a result of climate change, including sea level rise.
And then let's hopscotch back over into town in an area which is a chronic flooding problem, which is in the Mapunapuna area, where the water table comes up. And the last time I did a story out there, I saw fish on the street, on sidewalks.
Yeah, Mapunapuna is a glimpse of our future. The ocean at the highest tides of the month comes up through the storm drain system. Sometimes that water is fresh water because it was old rain that flowed into the pipes and never got to drain into the ocean. Sometimes it's salt water. The city put what are known as duckbill boots on the outfall pipes a couple of years ago, and those helped for a while, but it seems like they're no longer helping as much as they were. Mapunapuna flooding was especially bad during the recent King tides. Mapunapuna is an old arm of the lagoon. It has been filled, and the fill is subsiding. So locally right there in that neighborhood, the relative sea level rise is sort of high, if you will, and that's why it's experiencing what's known as nuisance flooding.
Yeah, I was surprised, because in talking to the businesses there, I was actually told that they have warned their workers that if they are caught driving their company trucks through that water, they could lose their jobs.
Yeah, when it's salt water,
it's very corrosive.
Yeah, it'll rust out the undercarriage of a car. And many of those businesses in that one little area where the flooding is worst keep a tide calendar by the front door. And they schedule appointments around the tides. And they know not to schedule an appointment when it's going to be spring high tide.
Yeah, it's amazing what, our lives are being affected by this in so many ways, with your business, your home, your recreation with our beaches. Can we talk a little bit about money? Because on the federal level, I don't know that it's very hopeful that we're going to get more money to deal with things like this.
Well, when you have a president that's engaged in denying the reality of the scientific fact of climate change and sea level rise, you're correct. We can't expect much federal assistance in these problems. One of the challenges to our state legislature is to look at the climate change problem and identify new sources of revenue that might be used to not only mitigate the problem, which is to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, but to adapt to the problem, because large amount of climate change is already in the pipeline, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Do you think that we might get to a point where we're charged a fee to go to the beach, or where that money will go to help protect that resource going forward for our kids?
That's how they do it in New Jersey. In fact, when you're on the beach in New Jersey, if you don't have your day pass, they ask you to leave. There's a guard that walks around, checks everybody's day pass, and you feel good paying it. At least I did, because you know that money is being directed to the preservation of that beach. So new sources of revenue that have a relationship to the problem where the money is being spent I think, you know, it's something for us to consider.
Okay. Lots to think about in the new year. Chip Fletcher, thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Chip Fletcher is a professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa's School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology. He also leads the Coastal Geology Group, which investigates coastal change over time. We've set ourselves the goal of a 300 new member goal by the end of the year. Matching donors, 808 Skate, the G.N. Wilcox Trust, and the Schaefer Philanthropic Family Fund will contribute $22,500 to HPR if we make this goal. We're currently at 121 new members. If you can help us reach our goal by becoming a first-time member today, we hope you can. Now, thank you to these individuals for their generosity to HPR at this time of the year. Laurie Okinaga of Honolulu, Primo Lagasso Goldberg of IAEA, and Amy Blackman of Pasadena, California. Make your tax-deductible gift now at hawaiipublicradio.org or speak to a real person at 955-8821. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, do you find you're paying more of your paycheck for rent? Well, you're not alone. But first, your quiz. Yesterday, we heard from Edward Lyman, the Large Whale Entanglement Response Coordinator with NOAA's Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary, about what whale watchers can expect this season. On Christmas Day, a Maui team helped free an entangled whale. Also that same day, a whale carcass washed ashore at Haleiwa and had to be towed out to sea. Lots of focus on these magnificent marine mammals. So for today's quiz, we're asking you about a very popular humpback whale, only sighted in Hawaii waters around, April Fool's Day. We're talking about the mysterious and mighty Migaloo. You may have heard of the humpback whale, first discovered in the waters off Australia decades ago. The distinctive rare albino white whale was named by Aboriginal leaders following his discovery in 1995 off Queensland. Migaloo sightings have been tracked ever since. Migaloo isn't the only documented albino whale. Here in Hawaiian waters, we're told reports about his presence come around on April 1st, April Fool's Day, though there haven't been any verified sightings. Our question has to do about the meaning of Migaloo's name. Do you know it? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Season's greetings and Happy New Year. This is Virginia Beck from the Public Access Room at the Hawaii State Capitol. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
You don't have to look far to know Hawaii is in a housing crisis. A recent study that tracks rental housing across the country throws some light on the plight of families as they struggle to make rent, spending more than a third of their salary for housing. Jonathan Spader is a senior research associate at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. How does Hawaii stack up with the national rental housing trends?
We try to look comprehensively across the different housing markets throughout the United States. So 2 years ago, the story across cities was that rental markets were tightening. We were seeing vacancy rates decrease, rents growing well past inflation, arguing about whether or not that tightening process is actually accelerating. In this report, the story is a little bit different. We're starting to see a few signs that rental markets may be softening, but most of that softening is really happening at the high end. So new construction of primarily luxury units is starting to soften the market for the highest cost rentals. The average renter today isn't seeing that relief. Instead, nearly half of them are still paying, or what we call a cost burden, so paying more than 30% of their income for rent.
We here in Hawaii know we're in a housing crisis. What do your numbers show how we stack up nationally?
Yeah, it's probably no surprise that Hawaii is more expensive than other parts of the United States. So the median rent in the United States as a whole was $980 a month. In Hawaii, that's about $1,500. So higher in Honolulu, a little bit lower outside of Honolulu. Some part of that might be offset by higher incomes. So on average, renters in Hawaii have a bit higher incomes than those mainland. But Hawaii also is facing higher shares of renter households with cost burdens. So 51%, more than half of all renters in Hawaii are paying more than 30% of their income for housing. That includes about 30%, so 27% that are paying more than half of their total income for housing.
Do you have any data to compare what it was like, let's say, 10 years ago compared to what's happening today?
Yeah, the last 10 years have been interesting for the rental housing market. So that 10-year period starts with the foreclosure crisis. And while that most people think about the dramatic drop in housing prices that happened during that period, it meant that millions of new households were flowing into the rental housing market and looking for apartments. So that, along with normal population growth, meant that the last decade's been an unprecedented period of growth in rents across the country. We added almost 10 million new renter households throughout the United States, and with particular growth among two kind of unique groups. So renter households with incomes above $100,000 a year accounted for 30% of the growth. Households age 50 and over accounted for half. And both of those groups aren't traditionally large shares of the rental housing population. And so we've been seeing the market respond a bit to those changes.
And what about the data for the cities, you know, here in Honolulu compared to Hilo and the other cities on the neighbor islands? How are you folks looking at the differences there?
Yeah, so Honolulu is slightly more expensive than outside of Honolulu. That's probably no surprise. The cost burden shares vary a bit across the state, but there's not huge differences in different parts of the state. Between 50 and 55% of all renter households are cost burdened. Between 25 and 30% of renter households are paying, or what we call severely cost burdened, so paying more than half of their income for housing. That amounts to about 53,000 households statewide that are severely cost burdened. So fairly widespread, and that relates both to variation in housing costs, but also to the incomes of renter households.
We are seeing a huge spike in the homeless population, and we have this added burden of having a lot of our housing units taken out of the rental market for Hawaii residents because they're being turned into the more lucrative vacation rental units. Is that happening anywhere else to the extent it's happening here?
Yeah, it is. So one of the unfortunate stories this year is, so between 2010 and 2016, homelessness rates throughout the country had mostly been going down, been made a priority by the administration. There were some increased access and priority access to housing vouchers and other forms of assistance. This year, for the first time since the downturn, we saw homelessness rates go up. And even more concerning, that increase was concentrated in some of the West Coast cities with the highest rents, Hawaii among them. That's a sign that increase in homelessness is being caused by the increase in rent and the lack of availability of low-cost units. Unfortunately, the most effective solution is to find availability of either housing units, beds, housing vouchers, some other way to help those households get into a unit. And that requires expanding funding either at the federal or state and local levels.
Did you look at all, though, about this anomaly of vacation rentals in this study? Or do you know if that's happening, you know, like I said, quite at the same rate that we're seeing it here?
Yeah, we don't specifically in the study look at the rising incidence of Airbnb and other types of rentals. But as a general phenomenon, so there's other research that digs into that a little bit more deep in more detail. And as you can imagine, as you point to, that does take units out of the supply. I think the open question is whether or not new units are added to replace those. And I haven't seen evidence that really provides a definitive answer.
We do have a situation where a lot of our rental units are aging, and there is a move by government to sell those off and have the private sector rehab them. But then along with that comes higher rent.
Yeah, and that's a challenge both in the assisted housing stock and in the stock of market rate units. So in the assisted stock, preservation is a major challenge for the public housing program, as well as for project-based and low-income housing tax credit units. So our estimates suggest that over the next 10 years, 1.1 million units throughout the country are going to see their affordability periods end, which means that those units are vulnerable to being converted to market rate units. And so some efforts to, often that's a moment where landlords can, through subsidized loans or other forms, agree to keep those affordability restrictions in place in exchange for financing or other ways to invest in upgrades or maintenance of the units. The other thing I want to highlight, though, is outside of that assisted stock, in the market rate segment, the loss of the lowest cost units has been remarkable over the last decade. And so we sometimes call that naturally occurring affordable housing, but that's really just low-cost housing that's renting out in the market. There's some efforts underway to try to find strategies to help preserve the affordability of those units and keep them renting at relatively low rents, but those units haven't quite scaled up yet to meet the challenge that's being created by the loss of that stock.
So what's the way forward as we go into this new year? Look ahead. It doesn't look very promising for the short term.
Yeah, and I think it's in many markets around the country, we talk about two things. We talk about trying to add new supply and then also finding ways to set aside or to provide targeted assistance either through vouchers or through setting aside in units with income restrictions. Hawaii is a bit unique in that geographic constraints mean that expanding supply is fairly bounded. That, unfortunately, for market rate units, that's a source of a lot of the upward pressure on rent. So if we're talking about the most vulnerable households, targeted assistance is probably highest priority. So finding ways to find available funding for either rental assistance or through LIHTC and other state and local construction programs to increase the number of income-restricted units.
What else do you hope this study does?
Yeah, I think our main goal is to try to raise awareness of the affordability challenges in the rental housing market. The story about the homeowner side has really been told over the last decade. I think less attention has been given to exactly how much pressure that's put on the rental side of the ledger. The second is to try to highlight the challenges that are faced by the lowest income renter households. So, you know, we talk about those in cost burdens, but it comes with real spending trade-offs for those households too. So if you take renter households that are in about the bottom fourth of the U.S. income distribution, after paying for housing, those households on average have a little less than $500 left over. Over the last 15 years, that amount left over has actually dropped by 18%, in part because of stagnating wages, but also because of rising housing costs. You can imagine that if you only have $500 left over to pay for all other expenditures, a loss of 18% creates some real trade-offs in what you're able to spend on food, healthcare, investments in education for yourself or your children, and anything else that you might need to spend money on.
All right. Well, John Spader, thank you. Mahalo for your time.
Good to be with you.
Jonathan Spader is a senior research associate at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. He's also worked as a consultant to HUD and as a researcher at the University of North Carolina. The Joint Center recently released a new report entitled America's Rental Housing, which takes stock of recent trends in rental housing and the challenges facing different regions of the United States. Visit the Conversation's Facebook page to find out more.
Hi, this is Dave Lawrence. We've heard from generals, grandmothers, craftsmen in their workshops, teachers in their classrooms, all saying HPR is the soundtrack of my daily life. Our support base is growing, but we need it to be larger still to sustain our work in the future. Your gift could count towards your 2017 tax deduction, but you don't have much more time. Please become a sustaining member or donate any amount today through our mobile app, and thanks.
You've probably noticed several headlines over the past few days about banks in Hawaii, employee bonuses, and raising the minimum wage. The bonuses are $1,000 or more, and it's got some people wondering if this is going to be a trend that we see elsewhere in Hawaii's workforce. HPR's news director Bill Dorman is here to talk about that this morning and adding a bit of caution about that.
Yeah, Catherine, not to sound like a Grinch in the holiday season, but I would be cautious on managing expectations. A number of factors that pointed to the banks jumping out with this, starting, of course, with the GOP tax plan. So the overall federal tax rate for companies going from 35% to 21% next week. Critical form of reinvestment is employees. And that's especially true when you're in a situation where there's a competition for employees within a sector. And if you look at banking in Hawaii, that's one of the interesting parts here. So you saw this progression. Bank of Hawaii started it off first out of the gate Friday, minimum wage of $15 an hour and $1,000 bonus. Then First Hawaiian was going to make their announcement on Christmas Day, moved it up when Banco did. Same thing, $1,500 bonus and $15 minimum wage. Saturday, American Savings Bank, $1,000 bonus, $15.25 as the new minimum wage in Central Pacific following on Sunday. So a pretty close peer grouping with that among those big four.
But as far as extending that out?
Yeah, you know, again, going back to that idea of competition within a sector, banks here looking at some growth. So we're in an environment where interest rates are rising, which traditionally is good for bank profitability. Also, a lot of local banks are looking at some modest expansion, growth plans out. So you have this idea of competition with a finite number of employees with some degree of training. Also, the background of this, you've had some movement in wages already. So First Hawaiian, for example, they had raised their minimum wage in October for folks like bank tellers, went from $12 to $12.75 an hour, a little more than 6% raise. Now, we're talking a lot more of a raise now going to $15, but that idea of competition within a particular sector. When you look at the overall workforce in Hawaii, although the unemployment rate is low, you haven't really seen that that competition for employees. You haven't seen wages move higher, generally speaking. So again, there's a lot in here that goes with the banking sector in particular.
Right, but it's not just the banks that will be raising the minimum, because next week that goes up for everyone on a small scale.
Yeah, small scale. And again, you're looking at those percentages. So it's going from $9.25 to $10.10, a little more than 9%, which, again, if you recall the time when there was the debate about raising the minimum wage, there was a lot of hue and cry about, oh, my God, 9%, that's so huge as an annual raise. Federal minimum wage, still 7.25. But if you figure, lots of different ways to look at this. If you figure an average 40-hour work week, you do the 52 weeks a year, that new state minimum wage of $10.10 is an annual salary just over $21,000 a year. Again, living in Hawaii, and just, again, with your last guest talking about the stagnant wages impact on rental housing, among other things, that's a tough situation. If you make that $15 an hour annual salary, just over $31,000, people talking about living wage, a lot of debate about what that means in Hawaii. But certainly what's going to be interesting to see is whether this adds any discussion to minimum wage, got the ledge coming up,
right.
And sort of seeing if that goes anywhere.
So if bank employees are getting a boost, what about the shareholders of local banks?
You know, this is another interesting aspect to this that you're not really seeing a lot of coverage about up to now. If you look at stock market performance to date, Dow's up about 25%. The Dow Bank Index is up about 18% year to date. S&P about the same. Local bank stocks in Hawaii actually have been stagnant, taking a bit of a hit. Banco Central Pacific down slightly year to date. First Hawaiian down about 15%. Each of those is individual stories and various factors associated with that. American Savings Bank, part of Hawaiian Electric, its earnings are broken out separately, but it trades as part of Hawaiian Electric. But one thing, if you look at price-to-earnings ratios on forward earnings, bank stocks in Hawaii still relatively expensive compared to some of their national peers. It's going to be interesting, again, in 2018 to see where that goes and to see how much this trend of improving profitability carries through to the banks. But in the meantime, they are feeling profitable enough to boost those minimum wages.
Okay. We'll see. It's going to be a happy new year for some.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director with a closer look behind the headlines. Next up, rat lungworm. The ick factor with this story is what gets a lot of people with rats and slugs, not to mention the debilitating effects of getting the disease as patients relay their experiences. Our Big Island correspondent, Sherry Bracken, has been tracking the latest and joins us now. Morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you doing?
Good, good. So you've been talking to lots of people about this subject in the last few weeks.
Well, I have. My first stories about rat lungworm were back at the very beginning, January of 2015. And what I've been doing the last several weeks is getting an update, because rat lungworm disease, or angiospongiliasis, still continues to be a threat. And although it has spread to Oahu, they had one case in 2017 as well as one case in 2007, more than 80% around 80% of the cases are still on Hawaii Island, so it's a big deal for the Big Island.
Now, tell us about the recent headlines. I know they were talking about funding and doing a survey that was initially limited to Oahu, and then it was like, whoops, we have a report in, and there are lots of rats that are infected with this disease on the Big Island.
Well, nobody should have been surprised that the Big Island had the most infected rats, because we've had the most cases. And the way this disease occurs is that rats have it. It thrives inside rats. It's called rat lungworm because the larvae thrive inside their lungs. To be graphic, they poop, the slugs eat the poop, and then the cycle continues. The rats eat the slugs, and the disease does not die in the rats or the slugs. But if people accidentally or on purpose ingest the slugs, they can get the disease. And what you get, the severity of the disease, really depends on how many of the larvae end up in you. And you asked about funding. The state legislators from Hawaii Island had asked for $1.5 million of funding this last legislative session, the bulk of it to go to UH Hilo College of Pharmacy, which has been doing research on this with Dr. Susan Jarvie since 2011. And also Hilo Medical Center has helped them with producing some educational materials. But what happened in the last legislative session, at literally the last minute after the bill, which had been approved by House and Senate, after it went to the Senate Ways and Means Committee, the funding amount was changed to $1 million, and none of it was given to those Hawaii Island institutions that are already working on it, and it was all given to the State Department of Health. So I did talk with Keith Kawaoka, who's a deputy at State Department, and you're right, they planned to spend, out of the first $500,000, the first allotment, they were going to spend $200,000 on a study of rats and slugs. And when I asked Mr. Kawaoka where they were going to do the study, he said on Oahu. And I said, no disrespect, Mr. Kawaoka, but why would you do the study on an island that had one case in 2017 versus the island that has had more than 60 cases, including at least 11, probably 12, confirmed in this calendar year? And that was in, mid. And last week, Anna Kothi, who's the spokesperson for State Department, said they are relooking their plans. And I think one of the reasons is they realized that Dr. Susan Jarvie at UH Hilo College of Pharmacy had already done a study of rats and determined that 94% of the rats on the Big Island, on the east side of the Big Island that they studied, had rat lungworm. So perhaps they're thinking that duplicating her study may not be the most productive use of money versus continuing her work or continuing some of the other work that's going on. But that's up to them. $300,000, they said they're spending on information. They're doing radio ads, TV ads. They're planning, Keith told me, on doing door hangers for hotels, I suppose, and other kinds of education materials. But they are rethinking those studies.
Right, and the interest in the subject is growing just because, you know, what we're hearing in the headlines over here, but from what I understand, it's also in Asia, other places in Asia as well, in Europe.
It is. It's in Thailand and China and India. It's actually been on the Big Island since the 1930s, Dr. Jarvie told me, but it wasn't really severe, and it's really gotten severe since around 2008. But yes, it is in other countries. And now it's also spread to the southern United States, and three members of the new State Department Task Force on Rat Lungworm recently went to a couple of different tropical medicine conferences, and they said because it's now spreading, there is more interest, although rat lungworm still is a relatively little disease if you look at it in the context of, you know, major illnesses. The problem is it's got very devastating impact since it can leave you with neurological problems if you do get it. But yeah, the international focus is going to help get more work done on it.
You talked to a number of people on the task force. What about the questions that people might have about their catchment water or their aquaponic system?
That's an interesting question. Dr. Susan Jarvie at UH Hilo College of Pharmacy has a PhD student working with her, and they have determined that the larvae from these rat lungworms can stay alive for at least 56 days in water. And the task force members, Dr. Kenton Kramer being the chair, said that water is a possible transmission mechanism. Now, relative to catchment, he said that if it was really easily spread in catchment, he would expect to see families with the disease, and that has not been the case, but they want to do more studies. But something that I did not ask Dr. Kramer about because it didn't occur to me at the moment, Dr. Susan Jarvie said she has talked with one patient and they're pretty sure catchment was the source just because of the patterns of the family. But a lot of folks on this island who have catchment may not use the catchment water for drinking. They may use it for showering and the toilets and watering, but they may have other water sources for drinking. So that could be a factor, but the task force says they are definitely going to study more about it. Dr. Jarvie told me that if you have slugs in your catchment tank, which are very easy to get in, the semi-slugs are smaller than your little fingernail. I have seen them, and they are amazingly teeny. But she said they can get in, but if they die, what happens is the larvae leave the host dead slug, and they just go out into the water.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Ick, right?
Yeah. Anything else that you can share that the people that you interviewed talked about? I don't know. Is there any hope for a blood test or a vaccine down the road?
Right now, the definitive test is a spinal tap, but Dr. Martell at Hilo Medical Center, who's treated more cases than anybody in the state, said, and the task force members agreed, even the spinal tap is not always definitive, depending on which stage of the disease you're in, you know, how many larvae you have, blood test. Dr. Jarvie is working with a colleague in Thailand and with the CDC on a possible blood test. They have an antibody-based blood test in Thailand, but the disease is a little bit different in Thailand. So in the springtime, Dr. Jarvie, working with the Thailand colleague and with the CDC, is going to do a three-way test to see which blood test works best, if they work at all. You'll love this. Dr. Jarvie sent 1,500 worms to the CDC so they could isolate antigens, and that is a total ick, 1,500 of those little worms. But the task force folks said that it is really hard to have a blood test for any parasitic disease just because the patient has to have had the disease long enough to develop antibodies. So that's a challenge. And relative to a vaccine, when I asked that question, Dr. Wayne Gosnell of the task force, I said, so what are the chances for a vaccine? And he said, yikes, which was not a good sign. He said that it's really hard to develop a vaccine for parasitic diseases. And Dr. Gosnell said currently only one human parasitic vaccine exists, and that's the one for malaria. And he said even that has only about a 30% effectiveness. So developing a vaccine is going to be a challenge.
All right. Well, Sherry, we look forward to more stories from you on the Big Island.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Aloha.
Aloha. Sherry Bracken is Hawaii Public Radio's contributing reporter on Hawaii Island and host of the podcast Island Issues. You can find a link to her latest reporting on rat lungworm disease in Hawaii on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
The 12 days of Christmas come to a festive end on January 6th in HPR's Atherton Studio. James McCarthy shares his original folk tunes, humorous stories, and brings everyone together for a rousing sing-along. Make your reservations for James McCarthy January 6th in the Atherton by calling HPR during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Earlier in today's quiz, we told you about a very special humpback whale and asked you about the meaning of his name. Every year, as the large creatures begin their winter migration, whale watchers in Australia keep a lookout for Migaloo, the albino whale that has captured the interest of so many. According to the Pacific Whale Foundation, his name was selected by Aboriginal leaders, and it means white fella. And Judy Jacobson from Ocean View is our winner. That was the answer we were looking for. Thank you, Judy. DNA testing has confirmed Migaloo is a male. Apparently, while both male and female whales make sounds, only the male sings. Migaloo, when he was first sighted in the 1990s, was the first all-white whale. Life expectancy for whales is about 50 years, and Migaloo is estimated to be close to 28 years. So Migaloo is middle-aged. That's today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Adara Panetta from the University of Hawaii Manoa School of Communications. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at some of the events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And today, the former bassist of the Grateful Dead plays on Maui. Is it tomorrow?
Yeah, it's tomorrow night. Phil Lesh and a few friends will perform in the Kessel Theater on Thursday. They take the songs of the Grateful Dead and other influences and interpret music in new ways. So not only loyal Deadheads, but modern-day fans of other jam bands will enjoy Phil Lesh and friends. This is happening Thursday at 7:30 in the Kessel Theater.
And if you're in Honolulu for the holidays, you can check out the latest exhibit at the Museum of Art School.
Right. It's called Lift the Air Show, and this exhibit explores how we encounter and experience the concept of air and everything associated with it. It features the works of 10 artists who use fiber, ceramics, metal, clay, and mixed media. A Lift the Air Show is on display at the Honolulu Museum of Art School through January 6th.
And if you're looking for new recipes for the new year, you can buy cookbooks at a discount in Hawaii Kai.
Right. The Friends of the Hawaii Kai Library Bookstore is selling cookbooks for 50% off through this Saturday. The library is located at 249 Lunalilo Home Road. It's closed on Friday, so it's a good chance to, you know, get some cookbooks and learn some new things as we head into 2018.
Right, try some new dishes.
Right.
Okay. Well, Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a look at closer events in our community that might be going under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation shares tech career opportunities at some of Hawaii's leading companies. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.